case, please. Wait just a minute till everyone gets in. Thank you. There's some seats in the front. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Peter Fitzner and I represent the appellant Jeffrey Stevens. In the absence of any act of violence, force, or threat, a protective order was issued against PhD student Jeffrey Stevens, effectively expanding the scope of the protective order statute beyond the conduct prescribed by that statute and expanding its application to prohibit harassment-type conduct, which in this case is unwarranted or unwanted romantic advances. This is important because the entry of a protective order has serious implications. The order is entered into the Virginia Criminal Information Network, so it would be available, for example, for any police officer making a routine traffic stop who might form a judgment about the person he has just pulled over based on that entry in the criminal network system. An individual subject to protective order may not purchase or transport firearms, must surrender any concealed handgun permit. Conviction of a violation of the protective order subjects the party to both liability for contempt and to the explicit penalty of being found guilty of a misdemeanor, Class 1 misdemeanor, which carries with it mandatory incarceration. Under Code Section 19.2-152.7:1, it's not any conduct which causes any fear that authorizes the court to issue a protective order. It must be specific, serious, violent, and hostile conduct. An act of violence, force, or threat. Those are the magic words from the statute.
Counsel, how do you reconcile your argument with the definition in Code Section 19.2-152.7:1, the definition of the term act of violence, force, or threat? That includes, it says it includes, but is not limited to, any forceful detention, stalking, and specifically here the trial court found that your client had engaged in stalking.
I had a little trouble hearing you.
The definition of the term act of violence, force, or threat includes the act of stalking.
Yes, ma'am.
So how do you reconcile your argument with that definition?
Well, because stalking also requires, it requires a similar showing that in that case it would be a defendant, that the defendant engaged in conduct that he knew or reasonably should have known that places another in reasonable fear of death, criminal sexual assault, or bodily injury. And what's different about this case from, there aren't a lot of reported cases on this, but what's different about this case, there was absolutely no violence or force, number one, and that was almost stipulated. I mean, that was the testimony by both sides. And the trial court even considered making a finding that although she believed the petitioner had been placed in fear of a violent act, there had been no act of violence perpetrated toward Miss Rose or toward any member of her family.
Stalking doesn't require an actual act of violence to have occurred.
It does not, but it requires that there be that reasonable that you know or should have known that it placed the person in fear of death, bodily injury, or criminal sexual assault. And that we have nothing like that here. There's not even, in some of the cases, there would be a phone call, you know, something like, if you don't talk to me, I'm going to get you, or this isn't over yet, things of that nature. There wasn't even anything like that in this case. The only thing there was a repeated There were a couple of emails over a few years. None of them were in any way threatening or suggestive of any violence. There was the 40 phone calls within a few day period, but none of them, most of them were hang-ups. I believe there were 4 voice messages left. But none of those voice messages were threatening in nature, just "I want to talk to you" was the gist of it. And then Mr. Stevens sent flowers to her work, and he brought flowers to her house, but he didn't have contact with her. She saw him from an upstairs bedroom, and she called the police. So he didn't leave any message with the...
Counselor, can I interrupt you a second?
Yes.
It seems to me that you're challenging the sufficiency of the judge's finding of a stalking. But your Simon Bear also seems to go to the question that the Chief Justice has asked you, and I don't think you've answered yet, that you can, whether you can have a stalking or not under the statute without some sort of violence, force, or threat in addition to the stalking. So what are you saying?
Under this statute, I'm saying you have to have violence, force, or threat, or it's not clear whether you have to have a conviction of stalking. It's not clear from the language of the statute whether there has to be a conviction of stalking. There was
Where
no.
Where did you get the idea that there has to be a conviction out of that?
I don't know. I'm just suggesting that it's not clear if such act includes but is not limited to any forceful detention. This is 152.7.
Right.
Any such conduct includes but is not limited to any forceful detention, stalking, criminal sexual assault, etc.
Why would you think that means you have to have a conviction?
I don't know if it does or not. I'm just suggesting that that's a possibility, because stalking is that act that's incorporated or encompassed by that statute 18.2-60.3.
Well, here we had a judge that found stalking. She put that in her findings. She said there's been stalking, right? And doesn't that meet the definition of force, threat, or violence under the statute?
I don't know that she actually found that there was stalking. She found that Mr. Stevens' conduct would place a reasonable person in fear. That's what she found. However,
isn't that the definition of stalking?
That flies in the face of the argument by counsel that there had been no threat in her closing argument on behalf of Ms. Rose. Even though there were no threats, it's the actions themselves that leave one to wonder. I think the case law supports that despite the fact that there are no threats, it is reasonable for her to be fearful. But the General Assembly could have included all kinds of conduct in there if they wanted to, but they didn't. They said it's got to be something serious. It has to be something more than telephone harassment, which Mr. Stevens was charged with because he made 40 calls, and there's a statute for that. It has to be more than the unwanted advances of a former lover. And I think it's important to note that Ms. Rose never told Mr. Stevens herself that she didn't want him to contact her any further. He was told through her father and through her boyfriend, and those are two people that have a vested interest, perhaps, in her not having a continuing contact with him. Certainly the boyfriend does. So, and his testimony was, if she had told me herself, I wouldn't have ever contacted her.
What part of no didn't he understand?
But it was never a no from her, and that...
But she didn't want to have anything to do with that.
But he didn't know that from her. What his position was that if she had told me, I would have accepted it, I would have gone away. But how many times has a father not liked his daughter's choice of a boyfriend and tried to discourage that relationship, or a new boyfriend that wants to make sure the old boyfriend goes away and is really gone?
Okay, well, counsel, in this instance, the boyfriend showed up at the father's house at 6 o'clock in the morning, hundreds of miles outside of his what?
He did.
Okay. This isn't your case, but let's take all of your facts and include that every morning when she got up to go to work, he was outside her house, and he trailed her in his car to work, and then he stayed there all day long, and every day when she left work, he trailed her back to her house, and the next morning, and the next morning, and the next morning. Would that be stalking?
I'd need some more facts, but I think that could be stalking.
Okay. So again, no threat, no oral threat, but the conduct itself was so troublesome that it would put a reasonable person in fear, and therefore it would be stalking. Now, let's return to the facts of your case.
Mm-hmm.
No oral threats, but a trial judge who found that the conduct was sufficiently troublesome to apparently to constitute stalking, and therefore allowed a protective order to be entered. It seems that you must challenge the sufficiency of the evidence. We have a specific finding by a circuit judge, a finding of fact, and that's the hurdle that you have to cross in front of this court.
And my position is that under these facts, that no reasonable trier of fact could find that a protective order should be in place, because the three, you know, cornerstones or the three requirements, the magic words haven't been met.
But counsel, we already established that there are no magic words, that the conduct itself can take the place of the magic words. You and I established that with the hypothetical.
I think that's true, but I don't think in this case that it rose to that level.
So in other words, it's the sufficiency of the evidence that has to be challenged.
And under these facts, yes, no reasonable trier of fact would find that a protective order should lie. And again, there was not, you know, I think the testimony about what Ms. Rose's fear was is important here, because she was asked, why did this make you scared? Because I thought this was over. I thought Mr. Stevens had moved on. I didn't know what else to expect of him. I'm scared because I don't know how he's going to react in the future. I don't know if this is going to happen again. I need some sort of documentation that it has happened to protect me in an event that harm should occur. But the this, in this case, is bringing flowers. It's unwanted romantic advances. It's not.
So again, based upon the facts in front of us, the relationship had ended years earlier.
It had.
And there was a minimal number of contacts for 2 to 3 years, I believe. And then over a period of about 30 days, there were dozens of contacts, either flowers showing up at her father's house at dawn, phone calls, but over a very short period of time. Would that not put a person in fear when they truly thought, hey, this was years ago that I had a relationship with this person?
I don't think so, unless she had taken the further step of saying, you know, direct herself to him personally. I don't want you to contact anymore.
What
it's really
the
over.
The fact that she doesn't return any of the calls, isn't that the equivalent of saying, don't call me?
He doesn't know that his position was, his testimony was, he didn't know that she was getting the calls. He thought perhaps the boyfriend was intercepting them and deleting them or not telling her about them. We don't know, you know, that was his testimony of what he believed. I see I'm down to just a couple of minutes. I'd like to reserve that, if I may.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the court, Megan McRae on behalf of Shelley Rose, the appellee in this matter. Counsel wants to state that because there was no oral threats to kill or any physical harm in the past, that this protective order granted on stalking basis is not proper. I thoroughly disagree. When we look at 19.2-157.7, it specifically, as Justice pointed out, defines what acts of violence incurs. In that definition, it constitutes stalking. This is a stalking case. Now, when we do protective orders, the burden of proof in a protective order case is a preponderance of the evidence. Unfortunately, there's not very many, if any, civil protective order stalking cases in the research. What we do have are criminal cases dealing with stalking. In those criminal cases, it sets forth a three-pronged test for what constitutes stalking. The first prong is multiple instances of conduct directed at a person. Here, we have numerous conduct. We have showing up at the father's house at 620 in Canton, Ohio, a place where the defendant does not reside at all. We then have him on January 5th sending flowers with a note that says, I miss you and I love you. The relationship was over in 2007. In 2008, Ms. Rose sent a specific email to the defendant stating, please don't call me. The defendant acknowledged that in his own direct examination. Ms. Rose also testified about that at trial. In addition to the please don't call me, she did not return any of the 40 phone calls that came between January 5th and January 9th. Not once did she ever pick up the telephone. Counsel wants to state that because Ms. Rose never picked up the phone and never specifically stated to Mr. Stevens, don't have any contact with me, he didn't know, he wasn't aware. But the case law does not state that she has to personally give him the information, I don't want any contact. He knew from her father not to contact her. Mr. Rose specifically said, leave my daughter alone, don't have contact. When Mr. Stevens called and got the boyfriend specifically told him, if you call again, we will call the police and we will bring harassment against you. When he called the work, he was told that she does not work there. The flowers were sent back. When you look at an unpublished case in Hartman, in the case of Hartman versus Commonwealth at 1999 Virginia Ave, Lexus 185, in that particular case, the defendant, through materials, sexually explicit materials over the course of 2 days to minor children. There was no threat to do harm. The only words that he spoke there was, would you like a ride to New York? I can get you a modeling career. But those girls who were minors felt that that was very scary, that he was throwing this sexually explicit material out to them. In Parker v. Commonwealth, which is a published case, in that situation, the victim did not pick up the phone calls that were being received from the jail. She let them go. And let me be clear, when I say she let them go, she listened to the phone calls. She never spoke any words. The court found in that case that her silence was saying, I'm not engaging in these conversations. She didn't need to utter other specific words. The other prong that we need to look at with respect to the stalking is that conduct which caused the person to experience reasonable fear of death, criminal sexual assault, or bodily injury. Ms. Rose, when her father called her on January 2nd to let her know that Mr. Stevens had showed up at his house, her reaction was one of immediate fear, crying, and shaking. That's what the boyfriend testified to. Then Ms. Rose also, when she heard on January 9th the telephone calls from Mr. Stevens that was coming at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then him showing up at her doorstep with flowers, again, she talked about how she was crying, she was scared, she was upset, and again, her boyfriend corroborated that information. Now, counsel wants to state that because...
One of the problems with it, you use the word fear, but you never connect it to what else is in the statute. It's fear of, and what obviously is at stake here, is bodily harm.
Correct.
This might be fear of further harassment. This might be fear of interrupting a relationship with a new boyfriend. This could be fear of messing up my job. I think you have a better argument than you're making, but I don't hear the fear of bodily harm in your argument.
The fear of bodily harm, Your Honor, in what Ms. Rose testified to is that her reason for breaking up this relationship is that he had anger management issues. She did not know what would set him off or when he would be set off at all. She had a reason to fear him harming her. Keep in mind, the email that he sent to her in 2010, he specifically stated, I know you still hate me. I know I don't want to do anything to make you upset. He knows at that point in time, in 2010, that his conduct of contacting her, of sending these emails, may be offensive. Reaching out to her via Facebook and LinkedIn may be offensive to her. He already is aware of that. Her fear of bodily harm, when he drives from Ohio to Virginia to find her, to constantly keep trying to find her, that's scary. Her fear, when he shows up at her front doorstep, of bodily harm, physical bodily harm, then coming to her. And when we look at another unpublished case, Your Honor, in the Burwell case, Burwell versus Commonwealth, that court found that it is perfectly reasonable for a woman to fear death or criminal sexual assault or bodily injury at the prospect of a strange man showing up to her house early in the morning. This gentleman, she did know him, but this relationship was well over in 2007. It is fearful and scary for her to have this man showing up at your doorstep.
But I'm not disagreeing with you. That's just the first time I've heard you say it.
And the other part that I don't feel came through on the record, Your Honor, was that there were a series of voicemails that were recorded. And the police officer also heard the messages while he was at the home after Ms. Rose called 911 because he had shown up at that doorstep. Her act of calling 911 further goes to show her fear that something bad, something harmful was going to come to her as a result of his actions. The other case that I want to also point out to the court, again, another unpublished case, is the Frazier case in 2007, Virginia Lexis. In that particular case, there was never one threat to kill, never one act of criminal sexual assault on the victim. What he did in that particular case, he drove up and down the street repeatedly. Repeatedly he did that. That was enough to cause fear for that woman in that case, and the court found that. I think the other part that the court needs to focus in on, with respect from the evidentiary standpoint, is that the series of steps that this man took to get to Ms. Rose, when the police officer had done the forensic analysis on his cell phone, he was able to pull up files of searches on her father's name, the father's address, on her addresses in Pittsburgh, her addresses in Virginia, her addresses for her work in Virginia, and where she'd gone and gotten her PhD. That was a lot of information stored on the phone. One of the things that the court also needed to assess and address at the trial court level was the credibility of the witnesses. Now, Mr. Stevens wanted the court to believe that his whole reason, his whole basis for trying to get in touch with Ms. Rose was because he had this report that was due on January 14th, and he wanted Ms. Rose's assistance on this report. First of all, it wasn't plausible. His whole reasoning, I went from Connecticut down to Virginia to go do some sightseeing, to do a genealogy, look up at the National Archives, and was also trying to get in touch with Shelley. That wasn't credible. The judge herself actually caught Mr. Stevens in a lie. On direct examination, there was a question about where his counsel says, did you do anything to contact her on Google Plus? And he says, no, I didn't do anything to contact her on Google Plus. And the judge says, really keep in mind, sir, that there's already been a document entered into evidence and received into evidence that Jeffrey Stevens has reached out to you and has added you to the Google Plus account. And his attorney quickly kind of moves off that topic because she knows that her client has been busted in a lie right then and there. This man constantly sought her out. And in the Shoemaker case, which is at 2005 Virginia Lexis 15, in the Schoenbacher case, I apologize for misspeaking it, in that case, the parties were co-workers with one another. The victim was actually the supervisor. She had given the defendant a very favorable employment evaluation. Later on in the day, he waited for her by her car. When she came out, he asked her out on a date. She refused. He then made some comments that she felt were inappropriate and, in her words, had crossed the line. She later on reported it to her supervisors. The gentleman was fired from the job, citing sexual harassment. After that, he showed up at her apartment. He was told, don't show up at the apartment. She actually moved to a whole other location. He found her at that location. She moved again. He later, a year later, sent her flowers and again showed up at the apartment. There was never one threat to orally harm her. There was never one threat that he was going to sexually abuse her or assault her. But in that case, the court again found that because she moved numerous times, she did not respond to any of his advances, that was enough for him to know or should have known that his conduct placed the victim in reasonable harm of fear and that bodily harm was going to come to her. Mr. Stevens was not getting the word no. And finally, for the first time, he got no when the circuit court again entered the protective order. For all of the reasons, Your Honor, Your Justices, She has proven that stalking has, in fact, occurred. She has met her burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence that stalking did, in fact, occur and that this protective order is necessary to protect her safety and well-being. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think that the closest case to what happened on these facts is the Frazier case, but in that case, Mr. Frazier was a total stranger, and so that fact in and of itself made it particularly scary.
So when your friends are creepy, when your former friends are creepy, it's okay, but when a stranger is creepy, it's not okay.
It was creepy, and he was up, yeah.
So, counsel, we have to draw lines.
Right.
And the challenge is that you've conceded that it is possible to have a protective order without any specific act or word or conduct that is violent. So the question is, how do we draw a line, and do we even draw a line when we're faced with the sufficiency of the evidence question?
I think the line gets drawn again when you have counsel arguing there's no threat, but you ought to enter a protective order anyway, and the judge saying there's no act of violence, but we ought to enter a protective order anyway.
But you conceded that there are times when that can occur. The only question is, where do you draw the line?
There may be times that this isn't one of them. This is exactly the type of case that was anecdotally discussed in the newspaper article, and I think that I cited where you have someone who left a dead fish on a porch, is anecdotally someone who left a dead fish on a porch and that neighbor applied for protective order, someone who applied for protective order against an attorney because they didn't like how the attorney talked to him. Ms. Rose never tied together the harm. She said, I'm afraid some harm might occur. Well, we don't know whether that's harm to her property, whether that's harm to her job, whether that's harm to her relationship. She never said, I'm afraid he's going to hurt me. And I think that's completely missing, and I think that coupled with all the other evidence in the case of no violence, no force, and no threat.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think she has to say it?
I think
she... Or can it just be implied by what she says?
Well, I think her words are very important in that case.
I think she has to state it,
because otherwise, because people who are scared say, I'm scared. I'm afraid of this guy. I'm afraid he's going to break into my house and do something to me.
All right, thank you. Your time's expired.
Thank you.